And thanks again to everyone that's helped us open the meeting, and welcome those that are joining us since we first started. We're glad you're here. Warm welcome to any visitors to us this evening, and a massive welcome to anyone that's new in the program with us tonight. I hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So yeah, we do have a speaker this evening, and I've asked Jay, well, Jay is kindly offered to introduce them. So I'm going to hand you over to Jay to introduce the speaker.
I'm an addict. My name is Jay.
Hello, Jay.
Hi, Jay.
I met this individual at the beginning of the pandemic, where he was living at the time in the country he was living in. I've been doing meetings down there for a while. And he showed up. And I'm not sure exactly how he showed up, but because he had been doing other online meetings or meetings that were being done for him because of his situation. And when he found NA at home, I remember him talking about lots of things. And I remember some discussions we had about the traditions because of the things that I believe. And we had some interesting conversations about service and everything else. And I've really come to enjoy times I get to sit in meetings with him and listen to him about how he recovers. And the perspective that he has on recovery from his aspect. Because we all do that. And it's been a real pleasure to get to know him over the years since the pandemic, because I've been running into him all over the globe, and we sit in a lot of meetings together, and we get a chance to share I'm not going to say everyday basis, but on a pretty regular basis. And I always enjoy those conversations and watching him continue to grow in his recovery, because we are continuing to grow, each and every one of us. So without further ado, Russell, would you share with us, and if you want to talk about the milestone that just happened, please do.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Thanks for the privilege of being able to speak here and share with you. Thanks for the introduction. Russell addict. I have the disease of addiction, and it requires.
Hi, Russell.
Hi, Russell.
It requires continuous treatment. A day is too long. I am a moment by moment proposition. You know, we talk about one day at a time, or whatever, and I've got all these phrases that run off. And someone said to me, how did you get to 41 years? Well, keep breathing. And one moment at a time is the essence. One moment at a time. The only dance in town is surrender. And that is an experience. It's not an act. That is an experience. And that experience is different all the time. If it were the same, I'd be able to go press button A, surrender. Press button B, same as A. No, not so. I need to be able to be with what is. And that's the beauty of this program. This brings me into the present, because that's all there is. The rest of the past and the future creates the psychological space for fear, the illusion. And this program gives me the capacity to live, not only in the moment, to accept that life is unknown in this moment. Because the next moment, as I have learned over the years, is not guaranteed. There is no guarantee. I remember my wife had just completed her PhD. She had the notice that it had been accepted by all examiners, no changes required. She went to the shop, to the Lebanese bakery, to pick up the fresh Lebanese bread straight out of the oven and bring it home. And she fell over in the gutter. Little did we know at that point that she had motor neuron disease. That was the first major sign of it. There are many signs that we picked up over later on reflection. She fell over in the gutter. She pulled herself out of the gutter. And she dusted herself off and came home. Within a week, they had diagnosed motor neuron disease, the specialist. Because she went down to see the physiotherapist, and the physiotherapist said, I think there's something wrong, you need to see a doctor. Life as I knew it, as I had experienced it, changed in an instant. Absolute change of circumstances. And I'm sharing this because it's about surrender. Surrender is an experience in that moment. We had no idea what motor neuron disease was. We found out. And I went from being a full-time worker, researcher, to a full-time carer. Probably the most challenging activity, experience at that time that I had ever encountered. Every day there's a change. A finger doesn't work. A toe doesn't. A foot doesn't work, an ankle won't bend, and so on, as the body deteriorates and the person that I loved, I adored her. She had a mind, a mental capacity beyond anything else I'd ever had the pleasure of being with. We loved being with each other. And so I was put in this situation. No, I was in the situation, not put in it. Nobody put me there. It occurred. And then they sent us to various doctors to check out the diagnosis of the original doctor. And that took months. And I remember We lived in a regional town south of Sydney, a place called Wollongong. It's an hour and a half from Sydney. We went to see this specialist in the hospital. And this was the last possible chance of another diagnosis. And he told us, this is what you've got. All the other people are correct. It's fatal, it's incurable, and it will run its own course. And she continued to deteriorate. And so the house went from a place we had bought together, we had done all sorts of things together. She'd done her PhD in with me. I was the reflection board for her PhD as she was going through. And at night, there was nothing nicer for me anyway. At night, I would walk down the hallway. She'd be in her office. And she would say, how does this sound? And we would toss around the idea. And then she would work out what she wanted to say, and then we'd go back over it. And it was like candy in a candy store. Fast forward a month, and she falls over in the gutter. This woman was amazing. Went through all the resistance, all the stuff to surrender. I watched her. We went through it together. She did her surrender, I did mine. Two very different processes, two very different people. And I'm sharing that because surrender, yes, well, the bones of it may be similarities. Each surrender is in the moment where life is. And she died. I married her. I'd been with her for years. We'd been with each other for years. And I married her less than 6 weeks in palliative care before she died. So we had a wedding in palliative care. And then the process of life, the experience of life continued. And the program of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions provided the basis for surrender to what is. And that's where step 7 comes in. Step 7's not about all this labels of character defects. What a crock of crap. For me, for you, it might be different. Step 7 for me is about seeing what is. The humility of being able to see powerlessness, experience it, taste it, feel it, whatever you like. in a particular situation. And to go through that situation one moment at a time. No grand plans. Go through it. Be with it. Sit with it. And to not know what is another thing. To be able to say, I don't know. I don't know where this is going. I don't know. I have no idea. In and out of emergency wards in the middle of the night with ambulances, cranes, the house, you know, in the room that she had. It was very large. It had a lounge in it. Well, the lounge made way for cranes for getting her in and out of bed. To get her to the bathroom. And to be able to do that without injuring her or hurting her. Another experience. And so it went on. And then she was dead. We had all sorts of battles with the hospital and palliative care. Because she wasn't dying quick enough. They have a little counting clock. How many days you've been in palliative care? And so we went through the stuff of the hospital administration trying to discharge her into my care, and I'd run my race. I couldn't do it anymore. And you know, the program provided for all of that. Someone had said, you need a bigger hitter than the hospital system. You need an advocate. And I remembered in the middle of about 10:30 at night, she was in hospital. I'd left her in palliative care. And I was at home and I was trying to whatever. And then, bang, there it was. Ring the consulting psychiatrist that treated me for my PTSD type 2 complex stuff 10 years previous. I rang him at 10:30 at night. He rang me back at 11. He listened. He said, how can I help you? This is Dr. So-and-so. And I said, this is what's going on. And he said, I'll do what I can. He said, what do you want me to do? He said, do you want me to advocate for you with the hospital administration? And I said, that would be very helpful. And he said, write an email. He would write an email. I got off the phone with him at 11:30 at night. I just happened to have kept his phone number, and he still had the same mobile number. And I rang him next morning because I felt quite uneasy about him doing all the advocating. I said, I'd like to be part of it. And he said, I'll tell you what. I said, I said to him, have you sent the email? He said, good God, man, I didn't get off the phone with you until 11:30. Anyway, he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I won't send that email. What I'll do is I'll walk alongside you for support. You tell me what you need at any moment. He instructed me in ways of dealing with a hospital administration that was really angry, authoritarian. And he said, he told me exactly what to do, how to be, because we went to a board meeting of the administrators. There's myself. My wife refused to go. She was lying in a bed in the palliative care ward. She said, whatever's going to be is going to be. And it's amazing what happens. Somebody who had been my wife had originally been a preschool teacher. And she had been the preschool teacher of somebody's kid. And she happened to be the head of something in conflict resolution with the family court in Australia. She was the head trainer and policy person. She said, I'm coming to the meeting. So she came. There was another guy through the ashram that we both attended, just up the street. And he said, I'd like to be involved in that. He was a retired CEO of a very large company and he was as sharp as a tack. These two people came to the meeting. I was told very clearly by the consulting psychiatrist how to behave and to make it very clear that I had run my race, well, they'd be carrying out two bodies, hers and mine. And he said, say that. And he said, shut up. So I did. And as the grand plan of the unplanned occurs, the general practitioner found it all too grisly and resigned as the general practitioner. And so the way the hospital and the health system works, if you don't have a general practitioner, services can't be so-called services can't be coordinated. So they had a problem. Me refusing in terms of saying, I can't do this. And that's one of the beautiful things is to be able to say in my life when I can't do something, when I've reached my limit. And that's a surrender in itself. And so they had a problem. There's no GP. No GP is going to take on that. And, who doesn't know you. And so they gave her extra time to die. You have 60 days to die. Wasn't that magnificent of her? She died before the 60 days were up. Now, in that process, there were so many surrenders. I'm powerless. I'm powerless over her disease. I'm powerless over the disease of addiction. And all of those surrenders to the powerlessness provided the basis for empowerment. Instead of pushing against the hospital system, instead of pushing that immovable 500-ton rock in front of me, able to turn 1 degree to 359 possibilities. Don't do a full 360. Step one in action. If I know what I'm powerless over, I can surrender to that powerlessness so that I can become empowered through 359 degrees of other possibilities. As long as I don't do a 360. Because then I would be back pushing against the rock, the immovable, pushing against a hospital administrative system, pushing against the medical profession, and so on. The other thing that I learned, not for the first time, to ask for help. And as in the case of the consulting psychiatrist, when help is offered, I can accept the help and then I can go and say, well, maybe that help needs a bit of adjustment. So that I'm not helpless, I'm not hopeless, and I have autonomy. Not control, autonomy in relation to me. And that provides the basis for fidelity and dignity. By fidelity, I mean trueness. And dignity, so that my insides through the steps and my outsides through the traditions are in concert as best as possible. And where they're not in concert, to adjust them and to recognize that they're not always going to be in concert. And it's in the dissonance that the creative possibilities occur. Creative possibilities that can occur, that I can be conscious and open to, unbounded to consciousness, allow other people, such as you need a bigger hitter than the hospital system. Where did the thought come from to contact this doctor, this consulting psychiatrist who I hadn't spoken to for 10 years come from? And that I'd kept his phone number. This was not planned. Life is not planned. And so yet again, the possibility of insides and outsides of me to be congruent. And that's the beauty of the steps and the traditions. Not just for group consciences and the way the meeting runs, and the stuff that goes on in committees and stuff. To me, that misses the point of the traditions. They're just part of life. And part of the surrender process, because it gives me a framework for surrendering to what is outside of me. The steps give me the basis for surrendering to what's going on inside of me. That is not defeat. And getting away from the ideas of defeat, getting away from the ideas of good and bad. Step seven brings it back to what is. And it allows me to start to work on what is, rather than what is not. It's the stuff of dispelling the stories and illusions that I tell myself. That's the beauty of the program. To be able to use the dissonance, the lack of equanimity, the lack of balance, evenness, and to be recognizing that that lack of congruity is the basis for growth. It's an opportunity. There are some opportunities in life I would rather not have had. Now, here's another opportunity to learn the opportunity, rather than good or bad, to be able to surrender to the situation within myself, and being able to expose the stories that I'm telling myself that are appearing as feelings, which are based in thought, and be able to get into the body of the emotion, to get into the physical body, which doesn't lie. Feelings are generated by thought. But first of all, I have to be able to utilize the feeling. I have to. This is for me, not for you. I hear people talk about feelings are not facts. Yeah, okay, so what? Neither are thoughts. What is generating? What is the root? And what is under that root of the feeling and the thought that drove the feeling? And I can sit with a pen and paper and write for 500 million years and not get to it. Need to be able to utilize the field as a tool, as a gateway to get to the story that I'm telling myself, to get to the stuff that is buried within my body through emotion, to get to the stuff that doesn't lie, that cannot be rationalized. I'm not dealing with rationality. If I'm dealing with the stuff of the thought that drove the feeling, I'm dealing in rationality. And you can't, I can't get there through rationality. I need, because my mind, my thinking, based in past experience, will want me to feel comfortable. And what I'm talking about is to increase the discomfort. Sit with it. Amplify it if necessary. To have that somatic, physical, visceral experience. To get to what is, and what is the story I'm telling myself. And then be able to go and say, is this true? If it is true, I give it power. True for me. If it is true for me, I give it power. If it is not true, it has no reality and loses its power. This program sets up the basis for being able to get to what drives the patterns. What are the beliefs? What are the stories that carry the beliefs that I'm telling myself? And this is about step 9. I'm on top of the list. What am I going to do about it? Sit and write letters. Make apologies. This is about the symbolic and physical, mental, emotional, and energy system within me. To be able to get into that. It's not necessarily comfortable, I can assure you. It's not good or bad. What makes it uncomfortable? Me. Because I want to feel comfortable. That's what my makeup wants, the human makeup wants me to be comfortable. So my brain and mind, call it what you like, wants me to be comfortable. It doesn't want to look at these things because they are uncomfortable. And the steps provide the basis for discomfort, facing up to the discomfort. How lucky am I? The discomfort of sitting there, telling someone what's going on within me. When pride says, tell nobody, my thinking about what they're thinking about my thinking, pride, exhausting and deadly, leading to acting against best interest of life, the best interest test, the opposite of surrender to what is, the opposite to being open to consciousness and focused consciousness in terms of awareness of what is going on. in that particular situation of surrender. That is a gift of the program. Neither good nor bad. Just is. And it's that experience which is part of the experience of surrender. Surrendering the bullshit. I'm 70 plus years old. How come I'm feeling uncomfortable? It's not because my teddy bear was beaten up when I was 5. I came from the academy. They were always whacking me somewhere. Good old addicted home, and I cannot blame anything on what happened 70 plus years ago. And that's what I dealt with the psychiatry, with the PTSD. That's 30 something years ago. What are the stories that I'm telling myself still that don't work for me? They're not in my best interest. They're the antithesis of step 9. To entertain those stories on a continuing basis is the antithesis of step 9. Oh, I put myself on top of the list and I'm still perpetrating on myself. Yes, shit happened on a regular basis in the family home. Shit happened. Hello, I've got a visitor. Hello, Curly. We're going to have to take a break for a second. Curly's come in. You got your ball. I'm a bit busy. Oh, yeah, I can't play ball just at the moment, mate. Thank you. I'm just a little bit busy at the moment. Yeah. Can you go and see Mummy? Oh, got me. Good shot. I'll just go and get Mummy. I'll be back. Where's the Mummy rescue? We're going to go see Mummy. You don't want to see Mummy. I'll have to go and see Mummy. Sorry, won't be long.
Give me that.
I muted you for a minute there, Russell. If you're back, just unmute your mic.
Hi, guys.
Oh, welcome back, Russell.
Yes, yes. One grandchild happily removed to go and do something else more exciting than throw balls at granddad. So, where was I? Have no idea.
Surrender.
Yeah, well, it's a continuous process. Surrender to the fact that I can't control the grandchild. We're talking about the dissonance. We're talking about the opportunity.
Yeah, we're talking about step 9.
Step 9. Yeah, thanks. Step nine requires me, if I'm going to be making amends to me, to come to grips with the stories that I'm telling myself that are hidden, with the beliefs that are contained in those stories that lead to the way in which I behave, that come out as so-called character defects. Just to talk about character defects, for me, this is where the real stuff is in recovery. So, I'll give an example. a recent one. I was recently sponsoring a fellow who went off his mental health meds. He was running his own mental health program. And a situation occurred, and he finished up threatening me seriously. Now, intelligence was to go to the police, which I did. After I'd been to the police, I felt pretty good. I've done what the intelligence thing was. A few days later, I'm not feeling so good. What's the story? Couldn't understand the experience I was having. Couldn't make sense of it. And then I realized by allowing the discomfort to be there, the stuff of lack of autonomy and control and lack of authority of me for my best interest. Complete loss of freedom in the prison, locked in the prison of the mind. The stuff of looking over my shoulder, even though the police had been engaged. So I came to this thing of the story is about lack of autonomy, lack of safety. And that was okay for a couple of weeks. And then this emotion was going on, physical stuff was going on. And then sitting with that, the story that was right underneath was fear of authority figures, and that I had given authority to this guy who had threatened me. Even though he wasn't present. And so what was revealed is the stuff around authority, and which goes way back. And the stuff of betrayal in relation to authority figures. The betrayal of me. And so once that had been established, again by sitting with the discomfort, the stuff of betrayal in relation to authority figure, whether they be authority in family, whether they be authority at work, whether they be authority wherever. I was able to see it. And at that point, over the next few days, it wasn't instantaneous, over the next few days, the realization of the stuff around authority figures throughout my life emerged. And that in this specific situation, it had provided the opportunity for me to see wear stuff around authority figures impacted on my life and still could if I allowed it. And once I've got the story, that carries the beliefs, that carry actions, which appear as character defect, the possibility of making amends to me occurred in this situation. This is the stuff. Of recovery for me. This is the stuff of being able to be present, to see what is, and to recognize what is true and what is not true for me in the stories I tell myself. Those stories are constructed over time. From the time I come down the birth canal right through to the present day. Circles of environment within circles, within circles, within circles. And to be able to get to the root. And it doesn't mean it's once and forever. Wouldn't that be nice? We'd be in Star Wars, Luke Skywalker, the Princess Leia. We've defeated the enemy once and forever. No, there is no enemy. It's part of humans. And to be able to collapse all of that past and future into the present to get to what is a gift of the program. A constant possibility of being a learner. No authority, just a learner. And hopefully that process of being a learner instead of a victim will continue for the rest of my life. The capacity, and that's the beautiful thing about working with others. I don't believe in sponsors. What I believe in is two addicts working through the literature. A line at a time, or a sentence at a time. Not slab reading, and to engage with the impact of what's there in the words to make meaning of it in relation to life, present life. And to be able to engage in that and learn through that conversation. That discussion with others. And that is a major part of my recovery continuing. The process of taking the data that is in the literature, the data. This is data. To take the data, to internalize it, to relate with it, to discuss it, to look at it in all its richness in the context of ourselves. And to get to that richness, I need the discussion. Otherwise, I'll sit there and discuss with myself. And of course, I'll be right. To have somebody who's another addict discussing the data, making meaning of it in the context of their life at that moment, not of 10 years ago, at that moment when we're discussing. Sure, memory comes in. Sure, I reach into memory. But the issue is to bring it to its quite consciously. Be open to what is this saying now? And to be able to do this on a continuing basis. And to have the privilege of being with another addict, discussing it, and questioning ourselves, and using the literature as a basis for self-interrogation with another. Where there's no one who is a teacher. I worked for too many years in the teaching stuff. What did you get at school today, son? Brain damage, Dad. My favourite cartoon I used to show the Faculty of Education every time I was had cause to. Did a lot of work with them and a lot of interaction. And I learned also how I learn. I do not learn by writing answers to questions. I can learn it by creating my own questions. And you're seeing how I can utilize the data in the literature to approach the question. Because what the steps have given me and the traditions have given me, a structure and a context for seeing the world inside of me and the world outside of me. It makes watching the news very interesting when I watch it. It makes for a different way of seeing the world through the steps and traditions, through that lens. Because when I arrived here, I didn't come straight into it, you know. I came via Al-Anon AA and into here. I had an ophthalmic problem because I saw the world as problematic, and so there must be a solution. And I moved away from that. We don't have a problem, we have a situation. We have a situation, then we have issues. Then we have claims and concerns and options. Which increases personal welfare. Increase options. Increase welfare. And It provides the basis for dissolving the prison in the mind. I spent many years in the prison of the mind in solitary confinement through fear, pride. I must be able to work this out on my own. Don't you know I'm a card-carrying genius? No. To explore with another addict the possibilities. Not the problem, what are the issues? But before that, what's the situation? What are the claims and concerns? Who are the parties involved? All of that. What are the options? Without this program, that is not possible for me. I start going into problem solution, it's all through the literature. Problem solution, there is a solution. Before I do that, I better stop. Otherwise, I'm just pushing button A. And I'm not giving myself possibilities. There is no open consciousness in problem solution. We see it. We see it all the time in everyday life. And every time I'd walk away, I am the problem.
Rather than we have a situation.
And the steps provide the basis for getting to what is the situation. Then what are the issues? And so on. Instead of this problem solution. So I'm very blessed. And I can tell you one thing for sure, in my experience, the worldwide fellowship that we now have didn't exist other than in name. Prior to the pandemic, we now have, I experience a worldwide fellowship. Prior to coming in touch with NA at Home, people reached in to me and brought meetings to me. They set up a telephone, video phone network because I didn't go to meetings physically and was unaware of virtual meetings. We were running, well, people reached in to me and made me provide a where we would set a topic and we would share on it. So one person would take, volunteer to set the topic for the week. We met three times a week. Who were varied members of the three kinds. And then it extended to, because of associations, Middle East, all over New South Wales, Queensland, I think Queensland, Northern Territory, sometimes into America. And now it still continues on with extensions into Mexico. And they're not official meetings. We now only meet twice a week. The membership of, or the participants in that, it's not an open meeting. It's very limited in size. And it's a different way of working with each other collectively. But the issue of the collectives that has been opened up by virtue is fantastic. The collective experience, the collective wisdom that is available for all the different cultures that can be brought to a meeting. It's incredible. It's incredible. Yes, I do go all over the place. I have core meetings that I attend. All outside that other network I just mentioned. Because they're not in a meeting. I'm very blessed. Thank you for letting me share.
Just there in cyberspace. Use the serenity prayer, using the word God as you understand it. God. Grant us the serenity. Welcome to those joining us.
Miles, congratulations.
Yep.